ID, The Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Abiogenesis, the idea that life arose from non-living matter through unguided, undirected natural processes, serves as the guiding principle for current research into the origin of life. We're regularly treated to published papers and news headlines about breakthroughs that supposedly bring us ever closer to figuring out how life might have arisen through purely natural processes on the early Earth. Just a few weeks ago, a Washington Post headline declared, "Monumental experiment suggests how life on Earth may have started." But what does the science actually say? Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. I'm your host, Eric Anderson, and today we have on our show Dr. Robert Stadler to help us cut through the hype and understand what's really going on with this latest abiogenesis research. Dr. Stadler holds degrees in biomedical engineering from Case Western Reserve University, a master's in electrical engineering from MIT, and a PhD in medical engineering from the Harvard-MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. He has a list of patents to his name as long as my arm and is co-author of the insightful book, The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Great to have you back on the show, Rob.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Rob, we've previously analyzed a number of papers on origin of life research, including a PNS paper titled "An RNA Polymerase Ribosome That Synthesizes Its Own Ancestor" from Gerald Joyce's team at the Salk Institute in Southern California. It looks like Joyce and his team have made headlines again with this new work, which another researcher at the University of California at Irvine called monumental and jaw-dropping. That's pretty high praise. Before we dive in to analyze this work, tell us, Rob, just a little bit about what this paper was looking at. What was it that got these scientists so excited and led to claims about this work being so monumental?
Yeah, well, Gerald Joyce and his team have been at this for almost 30 years, and they keep improving this strand of RNA, a ribozyme. So it's a strand of RNA made up of 182 nucleotides, or you might say 182 letters of code. And the code not only contains information, but it defines the shape of the RNA once it's folded up. And it's the shape that it folds up into that gives it a function. And the function of this one is to pull together other nucleotides to make copies given a template. So you give it a template and you give it a bunch of spare parts, and it's supposed to make a copy of the template.
Yeah, and I was looking at one of the news articles on this, and it said, in this new work, the Salk scientists created an RNA that makes copies of something called a hammerhead RNA. We can get into that a little bit in a minute. And instead of copying other RNA molecules, the article said, the hammerhead chops them. And after multiple generations, it says that each new generation could still chop and also grew easier to copy. So I guess that's sort of the high-level statement that gets people excited is, wow, this function was preserved, and it also got better at copying over time. And so they were pretty excited and said, oh, this is monumental research, and outperformed, you know, its ancestor.
Exactly. And the big advancement really is in the fidelity of copying. So when it grabs spare parts, you know, raw nucleotides, and puts them together to match up to a template, this one can do it with about 90% accuracy. So it gets 9 out of 10 correct. Mm-hmm. And that's better than previous ones.
Right. I noticed in the article there was a statement that said, it was a little bit sobering. It said, should the scientists succeed in generating an RNA that can copy itself, meaning they haven't done it yet, should they succeed in generating an RNA that can copy itself, evolution could then proceed largely on its own. So maybe at the end, if we have some time, we can talk a little bit about challenges for a self-replicating RNA. But go ahead and give us a high-level overview of this paper and maybe even back up a little bit, Rob. Maybe just sort of step back. Why is this idea of a self-replicating molecule a big deal?
Yeah, so if life started by purely natural processes with completely undirected processes, one of the required steps, one of many, would be self-replication. And so that requirement, having something that replicates itself, has become kind of a linchpin in the debate about abiogenesis. And so everybody knows that, and that's why these authors are really hot in pursuit of trying to find a self-replicating RNA. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental challenge that they face actually is similar to the challenge that Darwin himself faced back in 1859 when he wrote The Origin of Species. His main evidence was based on artificial selection. In other words, farmers that select the best livestock toward a goal, of course, of being more economically profitable for them, or the best plants to make good vegetables. And so most of his evidence back then was artificial selection. And he was criticized from the beginning that artificial selection is distinct from natural selection, which his book was about, because artificial selection has a goal, right? Mm-hmm. It has a teleology to it. And it uses human intelligence to achieve that goal, whereas natural selection has none of those things. And so that twisted Darwin up long ago, and that's still twisting up people today.
Yeah. So just to restate, his primary evidence for the power of unguided, undirected processes was a set of guided, directed processes.
Yes. And that's what you'll see in this exact paper today.
Okay. Go ahead. Tell us what's going on here. How does this apply to chemical evolution, I guess, this idea of direction?
So today we're talking about chemical evolution, which is basically the same kind of process, but applied to single molecules, not to a living organism. But it's very similar in the same kind of way. So we see a manuscript here from Gerald Joyce that's just packed full of engineering, and we're talking about 30 years of work in engineering to accomplish something. And then kind of standing back and saying, well, natural processes can accomplish this. It's kind of like, you know, if I was crazy enough to think that microprocessors came from purely natural undirected processes, because I know that they're based on silicon, which comes from sand, right? Mm-hmm. And I spent 30 years working toward developing a microprocessor, but all the while claiming that natural processes can accomplish these things. The problem is I'm just ignoring all the human intervention and the intelligence and the goal-directedness that's fundamental to the work. And that's what's going on in this paper.
Interesting.
So this manuscript is chock full of engineering, as we'll get into, but they downplay it and basically claiming that natural processes can accomplish this thing. And we need to be careful to separate what's a natural process and what is an intelligent, designed, goal-oriented process.
And there is a quote I think you sent me from the Daily Mail. Share that quote with us, because I think it's not only a little bit misleading in the sense that you're talking about of what's going on here, but I think it's also just flat out false, isn't it?
Yeah. So in their article about this paper, to summarize the results, they said, quote, over time, they observed the RNA polymerase ribozymes constructed copies of themselves. So that is completely false. They constructed copies of a much simpler, smaller RNA, mm-hmm. not a copy of themselves.
Yeah.
But beyond that, this quote makes it seem like scientists just mixed some chemicals in the pot and stood back, and then this happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's all natural processes going on, and that's also completely wrong. And it's not just, you know, the media that's hyping this up, it's the authors themselves. You know, Gerald Joyce, in responding to an interview on his own paper here, he said, quote, we are chasing down the dawn of evolution.
Yeah.
And so he makes it seem like it's a natural process, even though it's completely human intervened.
Yeah. And let's just emphasize that for a second, Rob, when he talks about the dawn of evolution, this is very clear from current Origin of Life researchers, whether we're talking about Joyce or Shostak or others, Sutherland, that the whole goal here is to get a simple self-replicator, because then at that point, and this isn't me, this is them saying this, at that point, Darwinian evolution can jump in and take over and build the first living cell. So this holy grail, I think you called it, what did you call it? Something like that.
Getting a fundamental step.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Getting this initial simple self-replicator, quote unquote, is just really the focus. And that's why he's talking about the dawn of evolution. Once you have that simple self-replicator, we're going to turn it over to Darwin and let him handle the rest.
Yep, exactly. And so many claims have been made about self-replication like this that I think the majority of people are completely confused into believing that it's already been demonstrated.
Hmm.
And I even quote a professor of chemistry in Israel, Adi Pros, and he wrote a book called What is Life? And in there, he wrote, quote, molecular self-replication reaction is a reality. It's a reaction that actually does take place. So that's a professor of chemistry.
Yeah, I've run across Adi Pros before. He has this idea called the kinetic theory of life, which we won't get into now, but that's something I've had an opportunity to critique in the past. But he's claiming that self-replication is a reality. It's already something that happens.
Right.
Yeah.
And many people claim that, including our friend Professor Dave, who has very, very commonly claims that we already have self-replication.
Oh, boy.
And so we ended up in a little spat over this with Professor Dave, and I thought it was interesting that he had an interview with James Attwater, who is from the United Kingdom, and he is the first author of a paper called Ribozyme-Catalyzed RNA Synthesis Using Triplet Building Blocks. That was 2018, where they also are working toward this self-replicating RNA concept. And so Professor Dave interviews him, and Professor Dave is interested in getting a confirmation that we have true self-replication already. And so he says, Professor Dave says, quote, my understanding is that self-replication was first achieved by Gerald Joyce in the first couple of years of the current century. And James Attwater clarifies that a bit. He says, so there's self-replicating, and then there's self-replicating.
Yeah, no. No, you either have it or you don't. Sorry, go ahead.
And it depends upon the context. And I'm continuing the quote here.
He says, how do you define self-replicating?
Yeah. And so Attwater says, quote, the first kind of self-replication is typified by this ribozyme that is cross-catalytic ligase, where you have two parts of a ribozyme, and the intact ribozyme joins those together into a new intact form of the ribozyme. So basically, you have two complete halves, and it pulls them together with one reaction to make a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole looks like the original molecule, so you call that self-replicating, kind of?
Yeah, no, we've critiqued this at length in the past, and I think even in some of the videos that you were working on, the wonderful series, The Long Story Short, you guys had a great example of why this is not self-replication. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then James Attwater explains to Professor Dave how chemical evolution couldn't come from that kind of self-replication because there's the two halves are fixed. There's no opportunity to have open-ended innovation or capacity to evolve, mm-hmm. so to speak. So you have to have a better kind of self-replication, which is what I think is more actual self-replication, right? But Professor Dave is undaunted, and he presses on in this interview and says, but we have demonstrated fully self-replicating ribozymes with this mechanism as well. And Attwater comes back in, and he's obviously somewhat biased because he's paid to try to make this possible and gets his research money and so forth. And so his answer was, it's on the cusp. We're now pretty close.
Any day now.
And I think that's a dramatic exaggeration, not only because we're not that close, but because Attwater is ignoring the mountain of engineering that goes behind his work. Mm-hmm. And not a natural process. It's quite an artificial process. And humans are working very hard for years trying to get this and trying to get close to it.
Okay, so tell us about now this new paper from Joyce's team that just came out. This is called RNA Catalyzed Evolution of Catalytic RNA. And this was what was referred to as a monumental step forward.
You know, to start off, to be clear, this is not an RNA replicating itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anywhere near that. It's making copies of another RNA, which is a much smaller, much simpler RNA. And of course, it's doing that with lots of help from humans.
How do you mean? What kind of help are they bringing in?
Yeah. So I actually have a little list here of the top 10.
Sure.
Engineering.
Yeah, top 10. Here we go. This is Letterman's.
Drum roll, please. Here's how they engineered this thing.
Okay.
So number one is there's about 30 years of work to develop this particular RNA that's doing the copying. And it consists of 182 nucleotides. I think I mentioned that. But it is perfectly homochiral, you know, perfectly linked, just like RNAs are in life. Mm-hmm. And you can't get that without the help of a living organism. Mm. Components borrowed from a living organism to allow you to build such a molecule, combined with 30 years of human intelligence and, you know, designed experiments and so forth to hone this thing and make it better and better. So that is quite a piece of engineering in itself. Mm-hmm. And then they put it in a solution, this magical RNA ribozyme that they've built over 30 years. They put it in a solution, which is an absolutely pure solution. There's no junk in there, no random stuff like you'd find on the early Earth, of course. And they put it in there with pure homochiral and activated nucleotides in perfect concentrations.
Yes, back up for our listeners a little bit there, because there's multiple things that you've just mentioned. First of all, we're avoiding all the other stuff that would cause interfering cross-reactions. Then you've got homochiral, which I think everybody understands. You have to have a particular left-handed or right-handed version of something. What's this activation that you're talking about?
Well, to be activated, they have to be in their triphosphate state. So like adenosine triphosphate, it's a highly energized state. So they're eager to react, but they're also kind of short-lived. They're going to fall apart pretty quickly. It's quite hard to get that in a prebiotic world, to be in the triphosphate state.
Okay, so they created these to be activated nucleotides that are ready to go, ready to be linked together. Yep. And then put those in solution. Okay.
Yep. And the just the right concentration with no other junk around. And you got to have some magnesium in there too.
Okay.
And that also is in the perfect concentration. And to make that clear that, you know, one version of their operational ribozyme needed 50 nanomolars of magnesium, and another version needed 200 nanomolars of magnesium. And they don't work the other way. So you got to titrate this just right. And that takes some engineering.
Yeah.
Doesn't just happen. So that's number two in the list of engineering things.
Okay. And so they're trying to copy. So back up a sec. So they've got this larger RNA, 182 nucleotides, and it's copying something smaller that's about how big?
Yeah. It's actually 34 nucleotides is the thing it's trying to copy. And that's what's called a hammerhead ribozyme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a well-known little piece of RNA. And it's small, and it has a real simple shape to it. If it had a complex shape, like lots of folds, then it wouldn't be able to be replicated. And the authors admit that. So they, on purpose, they picked out a really nice, easy target that's small and not too folded up.
Right. Okay. Now, I'd read somewhere that it was, you said 34 nucleotides, or was it 27?
Well, it's 34 in length. But to do the copying, this molecule that did the copying job only had to copy 27.
Why is that?
And that's because they give it a head start. And it's called a primer. And they kind of sneak this in there that they have to provide primers on both ends of it, which are pre-prepared strips of RNA that come in and they help the copying ribozyme to find its way and to get started. It's kind of a head start.
Yeah. And without those primers, if you just had the activated nucleotides in solution, this RNA would not, you know, meaning the ribozyme would not do anything.
Yeah, it wouldn't get started.
Yeah.
Interesting. And so there's a piece of engineering there. Where on a prebiotic Earth are you going to get these perfect primers in the right concentration?
And primers floating around. There you
and
go.
Pure. And so that's number four type of engineering. Yeah. And number five, going down my list, it's kind of hidden in the small print in the paper, but they also added what they call a cofactor oligodeoxynucleotide. So it's a little piece of single-stranded DNA that binds to the end of this ribozyme and increases its activity. It's kind of a little turbo boost for it, if you will. And where are you going to get that on a prebiotic Earth?
Yeah.
So they engineered that. They put the little turbo booster in there, and so that's another piece of engineering. Then once this thing gets going and it starts pulling in the individual nucleotides, matching them up with 9 out of 10 accuracy, and then bonding them together to make a copy of the template. The template mm-hmm. is this hammerhead ribozyme, right?
Yeah.
Once it takes about 24 hours to copy just 27 of those, so it's pretty slow.
Oh, that's interesting. That's incredibly slow.
It's incredibly slow, and there's the risk that the RNA will simply degrade before it gets the job done.
Why is that so slow? I mean, normally the copying is vast. I mean, and if you look in a living organism, I mean, it's going at breakneck speed compared to that.
Yeah, millions of times faster than that. Huh. So it's quite slow and hard to imagine that it could ever go anywhere with that kind of speed. But once it does its copying job, so it has a copy of the template.
Yeah.
The two are bound together, just like a double-stranded RNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they like to stick together, and you got to somehow get them to part. And that took some engineering. They had to use 8-molar urea solution. So you bathe it in 8-molar urea, and the two parts let go of each other.
Okay.
So where are you going to get that on a prebiotic earth?
But you've got to do that at the right time, right? You got to wait till it's all built. Otherwise, you're breaking apart.
You got to do it at the right time, just at the right time. Yeah. Somehow on a prebiotic earth, an 8-molar urea solution was spilled upon these RNAs after they replicated. So that takes some engineering to figure that out.
Do you happen to know, Rob, I don't know if this was in the paper or not, if that 8-molar urea solution causes problems for the initial ribozyme? I mean, does it cause it to disassociate at all, or do you not know if that was reported?
I don't know all that it does, but I do know that it takes a double strand and pulls the double strand apart.
Yeah, okay.
It probably denatures it as well and makes it a single straight line, but I don't know that.
Okay, yep.
So I think now we're on to number 7. So now, even though it's made a copy with 9 out of 10 accurate nucleotides matching up to the template, and it took about 24 hours to do that, the yield is pretty bad. So the yield of doing the first copy to make a complementary version is about 11% yield. Mm. And then you have to repeat the process and make the complement of the complement, which would be a copy. And that came out to be about a 7% yield.
Mm.
So 7%.
So why is that so poor? If we're doing 90% accuracy on the nucleotide, and you've got 34, we'll call them 27. So that's basically three potential errors within that one strand.
Yeah. That's the accuracy, but it can also just stop working. So so it might copy number 1, number 2, number 3, and then it gets stuck.
Right.
And that's all you get.
Okay.
And so the yield of making something as long as the hammerhead ribozyme template.
Yeah.
The yield for the whole process turned out to be a little less than 1%.
Mm.
So you got 99 pieces of junk and one properly length thing that it made in the solution. And so you have this big mass transfer problem now that put in a whole bunch of starting materials and you get 99% junk and 1% useful stuff. Mm-hmm. And so there's no way that's going to move forward toward a chemical evolution process. So what they had to do was step in and do gel purification to pick out only the good stuff. And of course, that takes engineering, right? Mm-hmm. A little bit of human intelligence there that you'd never get on a prebiotic earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got the copied hammerhead ribozymes of interest. And you got to make sure that you only keep ones that are functional.
Right.
And get rid of the ones that are malfunctioning or not functional. And so what they did was they designed a process, which is pretty ingenious, where each of these copied hammerhead ribozymes was kind of, let's say, put in jail. It was kind of stuck to this magnetic bead. And it could only free itself from the magnetic bead if it was functional. Hammerhead ribozyme has the ability to break a bond, break an RNA into two pieces. And that in itself is kind of interesting because it's a tiny RNA and it's destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's convenient for their purpose of the study here. But if you picture RNA world where RNAs are just starting to be formed and you're hoping they evolve chemically into a living thing, the problem is that the really simple RNAs are going to be destructive or parasitic. And so the RNA world soup would be filled with things like these hammerhead ribozymes that are good at ripping stuff apart.
Yeah.
That's what they're good at. And those are easy to come by.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit of a deviation, but I thought it was of interest.
Yeah, and that can be a legitimate, quote-unquote, function. Certainly, we need to break things apart as part of what's going on in living organisms. But yeah, that's a vastly simpler, quote-unquote, function to be able to break something than to build something new. So interesting.
Yeah, it's easier to build something that's a destructive.
Yeah, interesting.
So that was number eight step of engineering, is the artificial selection process that only the good hammerhead ribozymes would carry forward. Now, once they got a few of these good ones, they had to do polymerase chain reactions, so PCR amplification of those good ones to make a whole lot of them, a progeny, so they could start the next round.
Right, okay.
And that is another type of engineering. Certainly a PCR system is well engineered and also borrows components from existing life.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about PCR due to COVID over the last few years. Everybody should have heard of PCR by now.
Everybody's heard of that. Yeah. So that's some serious engineering and borrowing stuff from existing life forms that you'd never find on a prebiotic Earth.
Yeah.
And that was engineering step number nine on my list.
Okay. I'm glad you keep track. I've lost count of all the problems here.
I mean, just to compliment these guys, that there's a lot of engineering and a lot of intelligence designed into all of this process. It's pretty cool in a way. But thinking that it reflects or has anything to do with a natural process is kind of delusional, I think.
Yeah.
And number 10, we also we mentioned already in a way that all of this RNA, including the nucleotides they start with and the full ribozyme molecules, they all degrade over time.
Yeah.
And they naturally lose their homochirality over time. They racemize over time. And so you have to keep everything fresh. And the only way to do that is through engineering. You got somebody standing there, you know, adding fresh ingredients and getting rid of the bad stuff through the whole process.
And then what about this idea that, you know, it was getting faster at copying or something? I think there was something about that in the news article.
Yeah, so they highlighted that as an advantage or fitness advantage.
Yeah.
And they're in a situation where they have two goals, really. One is to have this hammerhead ribozyme get better at chopping, right? So taking an RNA and chopping it in half is its job. And they don't want to lose that function. But the process they designed is really focused on fitness, meaning ability to replicate fast.
Mm-hmm.
So as they went through like eight generations of replicating this hammerhead ribozyme, the RNA that does the copying could replicate it faster, which is good. But it actually, the hammerhead ribozyme lost some of its ability to do the chopping.
Mm-hmm.
After eight generations, it was only 60% as good at chopping as it used to be. So depending on how you define fitness, if you define fitness as just being copied faster, yeah, they got that.
Which is what they do, yeah. Okay, and so that was the part that I think people sort of glommed onto and were excited about, was that, hey, after eight rounds of replication, it still retained, you know, well, let's call it most of its function.
Most.
Yeah.
60% is most.
And I want to just emphasize here again, because we keep using this word replicating for our listeners, this hammerhead is not self-replicating. There's another ribozyme that is producing this hammerhead. And let me just talk me through it here, Rob. So what's happening is that the hammerhead is being replicated with some level of inaccuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they go to the next round of replication, that's being brought forward, that inaccuracy, and over time, did it actually lose length, or is it just becoming less capable? Do we know?
No, it didn't change in length. There were certainly mutations in it that made it easier for the copying ribozyme to do its job.
Okay.
So it wasn't as tightly folded up, I guess. that makes it easier to copy faster. But its ability to do the chopping, the hammerhead does the chopping, that lost 40% of its ability to chop over time.
Right. So we've got the copying ribozyme. It's replicating this hammerhead, which has been prepared initially and put in there at the way that they wanted it. And over time, after rounds, let's call it over rounds, it is having degradation and errors introduced into it, which reduce function, but allow it to be copied a little bit faster. And so that was the part that got exciting was, hey, we're able to reproduce this devolving hammerhead faster.
And that process, you know, takes us back to Sol Spiegelman, 1967, right, where he came up with Spiegelman's monster. Mm-hmm. He basically found that when replication happens, it ends up evolving toward a very simple thing that's more replicable.
Yeah.
Something that's easier to replicate. It's pretty much what they're seeing here. It's the same forces at play.
Yeah. Able to be replicated faster, but losing some function over time. Okay.
Right.
Just the opposite of what you need, or at least in terms of the functional piece.
And so I find that the title of the paper we're talking about from Gerald Joyce, it's, you know, the title is RNA Catalyzed Evolution of Catalytic RNA. You know, I find that kind of misleading, that maybe they should have called it something like a human-designed ribozyme under designed and optimally controlled conditions contributes to the duplication of a much simpler ribozyme. I think that would have been a little more accurate. But maybe they couldn't have gotten it published.
It's not a very exciting title. Rob, we got to send you back to marketing school.
Exactly.
Here. Yeah.
But I wanted to point out, you might have mentioned it already, but the last sentence of their abstract, it really concerns me because they actually use the term fully autonomous in this last sentence of the abstract. Let me read it. It says, attempts to recreate RNA-based life in the laboratory must achieve further improvements in replication fidelity to enable the fully autonomous Darwinian evolution of RNA enzymes.
Yeah.
So they're focused on fidelity, and they made some improvements in fidelity. That's what this paper really shows as an advantage. But they make it seem like, you know, if we just get a little more fidelity, then we'll have a fully autonomous Darwinian evolution.
Yeah. Yeah, they're being very careful with the wording there to not say that theirs was fully autonomous, but they're just sort of throwing that in as a, boy, it comes across to the person who's not well-versed in this, doesn't it? It just comes across very misleading.
Yeah. I mean, you can't have 10 injections of heavy engineering intelligence and then say you got something that's fully autonomous. It's just not even close. Yeah. And that's where we're at.
Wow. Okay. So this has been super helpful. We've got a couple minutes left, Rob. Why don't you just highlight for us again, because I think so many people are going to look at this like Professor Dave did and some of the others and say, you know, this is an example of self-replicating. In fact, there was that one quote from the, I forget which source there.
The Daily Mail?
Yeah, the Daily Mail said that this was a ribozymes constructed copies of themselves. So talk through with us just a little bit, Rob. What are some of the challenges of having a true self-replicating RNA, which, to be clear, this was not?
Well, one of them that we haven't mentioned yet is that an RNA will never replicate itself, meaning copy the same molecule that's doing the copying. Mm-hmm. You would need to have two copies. One of them does the copying. The other one serves as the template. Mm-hmm. And so we can say already that, probabilistically speaking, natural processes could never come up with a ribozyme of this kind of complexity. We're talking 182 nucleotides.
Yeah.
So simple probability, you can't get 182 exactly lined up the way you want to make this kind of a molecule. But to get two of them, two exact copies of them, of this, that could find each other out in the wild is completely absurd. And that's what you'd need to have self-replication as one big step. You would also need, as we said, the pure homochiral individual nucleotides and the primers that are needed. I don't know where you're going to get those.
Yeah.
That's not really possible. And you also need, in order to have a functional ribozyme, it needs to be folded up into a particular shape.
Exactly.
But in order to replicate something, the thing you're replicating, the template, has to be unfolded. So if you're going to replicate a copy of yourself, one of them has to be folded up nicely to function. The other one has to be unfolded to be replicated. That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Rob, do you ever find that being talked about much or addressed much? I mean, that's an issue that was brought up clear back, gosh, decades ago by Yockey and some of the others that were looking at basic stuff here. But I don't know that I hear a lot about that point.
I don't hear a lot about it. We mentioned James Atwater in his study. Instead of having single ribonucleotides in solution, they had triples.
Mm-hmm.
So three of them already bonded together. And so they're bigger pieces. That meant they had to have 64 different types in there, 64 different pieces. But they claim that that helped in duplicating things that were more folded up. So that's interesting. And then we also talked about the challenge of having, once you copy the template and the two are stuck together, somehow you have to get them unstuck, separated.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's no particular solution for that except this 8-molar urea that laboratories use. But they don't know how to get it unstuck without some fancy chemical like that.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a challenge.
And then what about time? Doesn't time help us, Rob? If we have more time, then we'll have more chances.
Well, we all know that RNA is pretty fragile. And if it's working too slowly, it will fall apart before it gets the job done. So time is definitely an enemy in this situation. But I can make a little prediction for you, Eric. The way Gerald Joyce is cranking out this work with so much engineering, I do think someday they're going to have a big claim of some ribozyme that copied a copy of itself. And there'll be a huge media blitz, you know, much bigger than this one. There'll be millions of people totally misled because all of it involved engineering, goal-directed artificial selection, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically takes us all the way back to 1859. You know, the same kind of argument that Darwin used, that artificial selection was his main evidence in proposing the origin of species. And we're just going right back to that.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Rob, for being with us today to help us understand what's really going on with these experiments and how far away they are from actually demonstrating a naturalistic origin of life with all of the engineering and the researcher intervention, I'll call it, that's involved here. Really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about the origin of life, visit us at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, consider sharing a link with a friend. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by Center for Science and Culture.